You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On January 12, 2010, Haiti suffered its most crippling natural disaster, an earthquake that left 250,000 dead and countless more injured and homeless. Today, a year and a half later, 650,000 people are still waiting for permanent housing, crowded in steaming tent camps where violence and crime are escalating. Add to that the spread of cholera, and many wonder what the future can hold for this nation. Dr. Paul Farmer has spent the last 30 years working in and out of Haiti as a physician and as UN Deputy Special Envoy. His latest book, called Haiti After the Earthquake, is a personal account of the earthquake's aftermath and a historical narrative of Haiti before the quake. It also includes essays from colleagues, volunteers, and survivors. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Dr. Farmer back to our show. Hello.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Many have referred to Haiti as a failed state even before the earthquake. Is that how you would have described it?
No, I wouldn't ever call Haiti a failed state. In part because of appreciation of its history, which is, as you know, came out of the fight against slavery and for building a state and nation. It's been a very difficult uphill battle, but a failed state is just cheap shorthand in a way that would allow us to skip over the history.
Well, why wasn't it able to establish something that worked better? Is it because of the hostility toward a country where slaves had overthrown a European power?
I think that's a huge part of it, and certainly most Haitians would start the story there. The problems that they faced in the 19th century trying to build a state in a hostile environment, hemmed in by other slave colonies for decades, and then to the only other independent state at the time was the United States, which is also involved in the slave trade.
Well, and their neighbor on the island had slavery as well.
That's right. In fact, that was in the earlier first third of the 19th century. The one of the Haitian struggles was to rid the entire island of slavery.
But it's as if the country is stuck somewhere between the past and the future. What do you see as the biggest issue plaguing Haiti today?
I think the biggest issues are, around the persistent poverty of the place, which, are, of course, is now complicated by an ecological crisis, and that was all prior to the quake. And the biggest resource, of course, is also the fact that there's so much talent on the island.
Well, it seemed to me that there was a real opportunity to improve the situation when the Duvaliers were toppled. But it just seems to have devolved into the worst kind of democracy we could imagine.
Well, having been there back in the 80s, that was a feeling so many people had in 1985, 86. The Duvaliers left in 86. And I think that's still part of the project. That, in other words, the struggle for real democracy in Haiti is really born out of that, the end of the dictatorship, and it's a work in progress. I still have a lot of optimism, as I'm sure many people do who work in Haiti.
Well, right now they're faced with very serious problems: resettlement, violence, disease, bureaucratic red tape. Why has resettlement been so difficult to carry out?
In this book, I used a medical metaphor, and I hope you'll forgive me, but as a physician, I do find them useful, medical metaphors.
If you were a baseball player, we'd probably be hearing baseball metaphors.
You would most certainly be hearing baseball metaphors, but in medicine, we talk about problems as being acute or chronic. Again, that's not a medical language, but there's this term we use a lot in clinical medicine, acute on chronic. So someone has a chronic illness like diabetes, and then suddenly they get pneumonia. It's not entirely the same thing as if the person didn't also have diabetes. And Haiti's housing problem, back to your question, is an acute on chronic problem. It's been a huge problem for many decades, especially probably the last three or four decades. The massive urban migration as the rural agrarian economy stumbled and perhaps collapsed. And so on the eve of the earthquake, there were 3 million people crowded into that space that really wasn't safe.
But this is an opportunity to rebuild and to improve things.
That's right.
What happened to all that land that where those houses fell?
Unfortunately, in the space of time since the quake, I think that there hasn't been enough urban planning and planned resettlement. It's been difficult to do. You mentioned some of the reasons. In addition to the chronic political instability, there's a lot of red tape, lack of resources, an inability to move, turn pledges of reconstruction assistance into programs and projects that are moving forward quickly. That doesn't mean that a window is closed on that opportunity, though. I think there's still a lot of chance to rebuild in a much more sensible, safe manner.
Well, why hasn't the money come through? The country received pledges of billions of dollars in aid from all over the world. How much has come through? And what about the fact that there are so many NGOs there? Aren't they working to correct the situation?
NGOs are working to correct the situation. The problem is that a lot of the work that needs to be done really can't be done by non-governmental organizations. It really needs to be done by, or at least coordinated by, the public sector, the Haitian government. And certainly in my field, in public health, the public part of it is critical. And so if you look back at the humanitarian aid that has been dispersed post-quake, the great majority of it, almost the, you can't say quasi-totality, but the great majority of it has gone to private organizations, including NGOs. More of it needs to go into public health and public education and also public infrastructure. So getting that recipe right is still before us. And if I could, Leonard, if I could just give one example, just numbers-wise, our peer organizations, other NGOs, raised a great deal of money after the quake, as Partners in Health did. And if you look at the one organization, for example, a health organization raised $138 million. That's three times the budget of the entire Ministry of Health. So this introduces distortions, and this is fixable, but it's going to require a lot of coordination.
Does Haiti have a viable public sector today that can be worked with?
We have to make it so. And if it was weak before the quake, which it was, the public sector, it's even weaker now because, as you know, the earthquake took its greatest toll in the city. Just again, back to numbers, of 29 federal buildings, 28 were damaged or destroyed. So the public sector is even weaker than before, but we've got to make it work better.
My guest is Paul Farmer. He's written a book called Haiti After the Earthquake. Then compounding the situation is that cholera suddenly started spreading. Now, cholera often comes after a disaster like this, but wasn't there some controversy over how it was introduced into the country? Many have said that it was brought in by Nepalese UN peacekeepers.
There was a great deal of controversy, and you know, I feel bad about that part of it, the controversy.
You're also working with the UN.
I am, but also I know that when on an island that is cholera free, you're HIV free or dengue free, on and on the list goes, epidemic disease that doesn't really have much in the way of non-human hosts gets introduced by other humans, and so it had to come from somewhere. Probably did come from Southeast Asia. And I think the debate that swirled around that really may have slowed things down in terms of effective responses for a while, and we have a long way to go still on cholera.
Well, we know how to treat cholera, don't we?
We do know how to treat cholera, and we know how to prevent it, which is the best way of preventing, of course, is to have strong public or municipal water systems. We know, but if failing that, you need clean, filtered water. People who are drinking, pure water don't get cholera by and large. So we know how to prevent it. We also know how to treat it, diagnose it. It's a very classic presentation of an illness. And it's treated by antibiotics. We also have vaccines that could be deployed more effectively.
So has it been brought under control?
No. The cholera epidemic is not under control. But again, this is, I'm fairly confident that a lot can and will be done in the next few months, I hope, to step up prevention efforts, but also what's called case finding the cases and treating them. And I hope deploying other tools that haven't been used yet in Haiti, like vaccine.
We'll take a little break and come back with Dr. Paul Farmer. His book, Haiti After the Earthquake, is published by Public Affairs. We're back with Paul Farmer. His latest book, Haiti After the Earthquake, is published by Public Affairs. What about the people who live outside of Port-au-Prince? How have their lives changed?
Well, most of my experience as a physician has been with those people living in the rural areas. And after as I mentioned, so much of this migration to the city has happened in recent years. These are really the same people. The ones in the city are really from the countryside. So the impact of the quake on people living in the countryside was their kin, who survived the quake or were injured, went back out in the countryside. And so they're internally displaced, included those living in the tents and camps, but also those who were going back to villages to overcrowded and under-resourced homes.
So the villages are becoming crowded as well.
Exactly.
Were there, weren't you, when the earthquake
started? I was. I had just left my family and I. We just left Haiti, I feel fortunate that we were not there in the city because we'd spent the holidays there, and I went right back afterwards.
A year before the earthquake, you had accepted a post as UN Deputy Special Envoy for Haiti under former President Bill Clinton. How had he gotten involved?
He has been going to Haiti since his honeymoon, actually, and had been there many times. It was an area when he was president of the United States. There was a lot going on in Haiti, as you mentioned. You mentioned the end of the Duvalier dictatorship. That was prior to President Clinton's election, but there was a coup shortly before Clinton came into office. And so Haiti was on the front burner back in 1992, and restoration of constitutional rule in Haiti actually happened, during President Clinton's tenure.
Well, he's also apologized for some of his policies.
He has. And, I found it very moving when he talked about the impact of agricultural subsidies in the United States on Haitian agriculture and the press to lift import tariffs. When he described that after the quake as a mistake.
This involved sugar, mostly?
It involved sugar, especially he was talking about sugar and rice, actually. Excuse me, I to correct myself, he was talking about rice. But the same story holds for lots of other agricultural produce that Haiti had long been growing and was is really unable to keep up with these trade policies in United States and Europe.
Will Barack Obama be apologizing for his administration's actions after he leaves office?
Around Haiti, I think that I think actually the U.S. government has been really trying hard to improve the quality of our development assistance and humanitarian aid to Haiti. It's clear when we say, this kind of slogan, build back better, regarding Haiti, it's not just building Haiti back better after the quake. It's building humanitarian assistance and development aid back better. It's a broken system and has been for a long time.
There have been many critics of the work that foreign organizations are doing in Haiti. One representative of the Organization of American States, Ricardo Seitenfuss, who was removed from his position because of his comments, said in an interview, if there is proof of the failure of international aid, it is Haiti. Emergency aid is effective, but when it becomes structural, when it replaces the state in all its duties, collective responsibilities in society end up abandoned.
I think that's right. I think that's correct.
So it's kind of like a welfare patient?
Well, I think it's a little bit worse than that, really, because there's a lot of goodwill. And that gets translated into resources. If you look at the number of American households who donated to earthquake relief in Haiti, Secretary Clinton suggested that it was more than half of all households. So that part of immediate relief, I've said in this book that I don't think we're going to look back and say that it was bad. The question really is how do you move from relief to reconstruction? And that requires strengthening, as I said, public health, public education, public infrastructure. And right now, a lot of the money, or most of the money, is still going into non-governmental organizations, private, the humanitarian machine when this is reconstruction work.
Including foreign militaries.
And, having worked with some of them after the quake, I was very grateful for their logistic help. And they opened up the airport. The one expensive investment, but one well worth the time and effort, I think, was the U.S. naval ship, the Comfort, which steamed into harbor on day 8, providing lots of new operating rooms. You can have a critique of that, but you wouldn't be critiquing it if you needed the orthopedic care that we found available. But again, they would be the first to say, I think some of the military people would be the first to say, that's not the same as rebuilding public health systems.
Well, following this up, what you've been saying all along, we hear a lot about foreign players in the Haiti situation, but how involved are Haitian officials in all of this?
There's been a lot of, first of all, loss there. Since the earthquake struck at the nerve center, and I mentioned already that 28 of 29 federal buildings were collapsed, you can imagine the number of Haitian officials who died was very substantial.
And that on top of the fact that Haiti has been hit by a lot of hurricanes, hasn't it? Isn't it a very bad place?
Yeah, it is. Of course, Haiti's a great place and the wonderful people, but you have to look at the political situation. Say there's so much instability here, and on top of that, you have the hurricanes and the earthquake. It's been a lot, and it's going to take a lot to crawl out or dig out from that.
Well, you write about the need for job creation in Haiti. Does it make sense to focus on jobs when rebuilding is still in its infant stage? And would it be easier in Haiti than it's turning out to be in our own country?
I think that job creation, decent jobs with good labor conditions, it's really a key to rebuilding. Just an example from our own experience, quite literally building infrastructure, a hospital, for example, building a huge hospital in central Haiti, which we'd like to be a center of medical education, that's created hundreds and hundreds of jobs and also transfer of capacity to expert builders, people learning how to do solar power, et cetera. I just think there's so many positive outcomes to projects that focus on local job creation. That we should put more energy into that, not less.
How responsible is the United States for Haiti's problems? We mentioned Bill Clinton's apology, but the United States occupied Haiti for 19 years, and we've meddled in its politics for much of its history.
That's very true. I mean, Haiti and the United States are the two oldest countries in this hemisphere, so they necessarily have this long history of being intertwined. I think most Haitians are very aware of it. Most Americans are not. And, looking back at the 19th century and up into the occupation and through the occupation, it's not a very distinguished history.
There's also been a serious brain drain.
Yeah. I look at some of the talent in the medical community in Boston and New York and Miami and Montreal, a lot of, just looking at my own peers, a lot of nurses and doctors are Haitian. And it's clear that, when offered a chance, educational opportunities and a chance to become professionals, Haitians flourish. I'd like to see that happen in Haiti, as would most of the Haitians I know.
Is there any reason for people to return?
There will be a reason when we can help Haitians rebuild these institutions in a, I was going to say collegial manner, but in a way that respects their sovereignty and dignity.
You spent years doing work in Rwanda as well, and you make comparisons in the book between both countries. How was Rwanda able to prosper economically after its devastating genocide?
The easy answer would be, good leadership. And I think it's important to underline that. They have clearly have a vision, a national vision that it doesn't necessarily come from the top, but it's strongly endorsed by the the leadership of the country, the president, the cabinet. It's also, they've spent a lot of time soul-searching after the genocide. Who are we as a people? What is our future? How can we rebuild? And pushing forward a national plan for recovery. And it's our hope that some of the lessons that they've learned in rebuilding over the last 17 years will prove helpful in Haiti.
I mentioned that other people have also written essays for the book, and one of them is from Edwige Dandekot, who is a wonderful novelist and has written a lot about her travels back and forth. And she writes about the misinterpretation of grace, patience, and courage as complacency. The tragedy is nothing new to the Haitian people, but how did they deal with it?
Well, as she points out in her essay, there's a great deal of focus in Haiti on family, and families, including her own, for those who've read her memoirs, have been divided by, again, this instability, poverty, and so there's a lot of families stretch from Haiti into another country, and most notably the United States, but Canada and parts of Europe. And I think that's another resource that we can draw on in rebuilding. People like Edwige.
A listener posted a comment and question on our homepage. Quote, I've heard you say that the key to Haiti's revival will be investing in Haiti's institutions. If we focused on educating Haitians in agrarian and economic fields, would we not see a rapid turnaround in 12 years or so?
I think that certainly that's an important investment. But investing in education only without thinking about the infrastructure is not going to be enough in agriculture. And what I mean by infrastructure is everything from irrigation, water, access to fertilizer, protecting the soil. Again, some of the things that I've seen happen in Rwanda. I'm no expert in this arena, but I know that there's already a lot of knowledge in the agrarian economy in Haiti. And if we can link that to some substantial investments in infrastructure, I think it would be very helpful. And the same could be said, I believe, about the areas I know better, healthcare and education.
Well, one of Haiti's leading agronomists who wound up running his own radio station, who was a guest on the show a couple of times, was assassinated.
That's right.
So is it possible for people who of goodwill to speak out in Haiti?
I believe it is possible. A lot of people, his wife, by the way, his widow, wrote one of the essays in this book. And, there are people like Jean-Dominique who have taken enormous risks to improve Haitian society and to make Haiti a better place to. And they've paid very heavy price, but there's still lots of people there who are willing to do so and look up to people like Jean-Dominique. I know that's not true only in Haiti. It's regarded very highly throughout the world. I think there are Haiti's got leaders like that.
Paul Farmer is the Colocotrones University professor at Harvard University.
Colocotrones, yeah.
He's chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School and chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, co-founder of Partners in Health, and serves as UN Deputy Special Envoy for Haiti under Special Envoy Bill Clinton. His latest book is Haiti After the Earthquake. It is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being
with
us again.
Thank you for having me back.